Okay, we will go ahead and start. You can turn in papers after, and the affect-effect exercises will be available on the table after. Okay? So, and for those of you who were trying to email your paper or print it out using the UVM web, there really was a problem. They were having storage problems, and they probably lost all your stuff. Don't worry about it. They'll find it. But email was down for about, well, for the last hour. And you knew that. Okay. Happy Monday. Now that you have tried the Muller activity exercise, what questions came up while you were doing that? Any of you run into Muller activities that weren't Muller? Or questions about an example you tried to use and decided not to use because you had too many questions about it? You learn anything? Piece of cake? No problem? Okay. Talia will be the judge of that over the week. And we'll try to get those back to you on Monday next week. Yes? Are momentum and intent really separate from each other? Is that the question? Can you talk about momentum without talking about intent? Can you talk about intent without implying the momentum? Probably they are not independent of each other. And probably when you're trying to describe them separately, you're going to find some interlocking there. I think it's one of those situations where Bronfenbrenner and lots of us figure, well, these two are really important things, but wasn't really asserting that they're separate. When you have the intent to do something, it probably carries momentum with it. To say that something has momentum probably implies that there's some purpose in doing it, although the challenge might be to see if you could come up with an activity that had momentum that might not be particularly purposeful, or for which the intention might not be very clear, or vice versa. Are there things that you do that you could perhaps stop doing and it would be okay? They have some purpose, but they don't have much momentum. And I think you could probably do that, and Bronfenbrenner would be arguing that you probably do need to have both. For example, let me give you examples. I think I can do it for both. Did any of you come up with something that might be have momentum but not purpose? Or purpose without momentum? Yeah. Bad habits. Yes, bad habits. Precisely. You might not really have any intent. They themselves might have no intent. You might not even intend to do them, but there they are. In fact, they might have the intent of, I don't want to get personal and ask you about your bad habits, so I won't. But does anybody have one they want to confess to that would be purposeless?
Watching too much TV. Does that count as a bad habit?
certainly would count as a bad habit. Watching television at all is probably a bad habit, unless you're watching educational television. It's a bad habit. Does it have momentum? Or does it have inertia? Okay, the difference. Momentum means that something tends to continue. Inertia means that something tends to continue because you can't think of anything better to do and you can't stop doing it. I was waiting for somebody to come up with procrastination, because part of the purpose or the gain in doing something that is basically purposeless is that it keeps you from having to tackle something that really does have momentum and intent, like your work or hygiene or whatever it is that you like to avoid. Exercise, fitness, all of those things. Okay, so you can maybe make a case that there are things that you actually do that might have momentum, if we take bad habits like watching television, because you can't give them up, and if somebody interferes with it, you get upset. But its purpose may not, all by itself, you may not be learning anything from the television watching that you're zoned out at. Okay? I'm thinking of some folks that I have worked with over the years who have activities, I guess, that have intense momentum, furious momentum, and that are basically purposeless. And those are people with symptoms of a psychomotor sort. I can think of some that aren't psychomotor, too. The engaging in some behavior furiously with incredible momentum, unable to stop it, unwilling to let anybody else stop it, and you have to do it. It's an obsession. But when you ask them why they're doing it, they don't have a clue. And it doesn't serve any particular purpose for them. And Bronfenbrenner, I think, would say, because it doesn't have any purpose, because it doesn't have any intent, that kind of symptom is really not a molar activity. And it might even get, we might argue that it would get more complex. But because of its absence of intent, it would not qualify for him as a molar activity. Yes? Addictions are interesting because addictions, if you're thinking of alcohol, drug, food, those addictions typically have a purpose. And they are maintained partly to avoid not having the substance. They clearly have momentum. And they often represent very complex behaviors. You can think about the physiological part of an addiction to heroin, for example, but the molar activity becomes very complex, particularly if you're able to or intend to maintain your addiction without withdrawal, without disrupting the rest of your life and destroying your relationships and losing your job. So you have to figure out how to get enough money to keep your supply going, how to maintain the other supports in your life so that you can maintain this addiction. And addicts, at least the few that I have known personally, have intent. They know what they're trying to do. And it's not just avoid the withdrawal. As one of them said to me, you know, there's a reason they call it a fix. It fixes all of your problems. You don't have to worry about them. They all seem to go away in your opiate haze. So it does have a purpose and an intent and incredible momentum. So I argue, and I use it in the book as an example, that the addictions typically are molar activities. And particularly because they concern us socially and they have a developmental history. So we want to understand how they arise. You don't get into an addiction of any sort without going through some process of development that is supported by your ecosystem. And it shapes the ecosystem and your further development. But the kind of psychomotor symptoms that somebody who has a psychiatric condition engages in may not fall in that category of molar activity. Let me use that as an opportunity to remind you that Bronfenbrenner was very clear that what he was doing was trying to be clear, trying to provide concepts that are useful, but he was clear that it might not be the last word. He put out his perspective specifically so that people could argue about it, so that people could test it. And he invited all of us, including you, to wrestle with the concepts and the constructs and the hypotheses and find examples, find problems, and see if you can improve it. So he saw this as an open source system, if you like that analogy, where people can tinker with it, and if your tinkering or your changing of concepts is useful, then it will be adopted. If you find a hypothesis that doesn't seem to work in your life and you can't find any place else where it might apply or where it needs massaging, feel free to change it. Feel free to come up with your own hypotheses. I have a couple that I'll mention as we go along, and other people have added, although not many, to them. He saw it as a system that would allow you to elaborate it, to extend it, to argue about it, to generate research and argument about it, and people in the field do take that seriously. So I'll give you a couple of my suggestions for how the system can be extended and still be consistent. That's the challenge. Can you extend it? Can you find new, can you create or construct new hypotheses that are consistent with the rest of it? And I think that's probably quite doable, and I invite you to do it. We will see several other places where it's really not clear what he meant when, and that's one of the reasons we try to do the exercises focused on those, because it raises those questions. Okay. Any other examples or questions? Thank you for that. That's a good one, and there'll be other examples of that actually today in my presentation, of where it's not clear that something, that two things are separate, because they seem to imply each other, and that's often the case in this system, that things are not surgically discrete from each other, because probably that's not the way human development or life work, or yeah, either of them work. Yeah. Anything else on activities? You're okay? Okay. When we finished, as we were finishing talking about molar activities, we looked at hypothesis one, this is from last week, that the development of the person is a function of the variety and complexity of the molar activities engaged in by others who become part of the psychological field by either involving, by engaging your attention or your participation. So we need to talk about others and what happens when somebody becomes part of your psychological field. And that raises the topic of relation, which is what we're going to talk about today. Relation and dyad. Right enough? Zoom in. Okay, the topic for today. And maybe we'll go beyond this, but probably not. Usually we get hung up enough on this one that it takes the rest of the day. A relation obtains whenever one person in a setting pays attention to or participates in the activities of another. Okay. So you can see that the earlier hypothesis leads directly to this interest. Aha! What happens when you're doing something, or you get interested in somebody else's doing something, or participate in it, then you're creating a relation with that person, and you're creating a dyad. And the dyad is formed whenever two persons pay attention to or participate in each other's activities. So, now we get to the fact that we're not all individuals. We, in fact, engage in relations. And when we're engaged with one other person, that's a dyad, that's two people. So, if there are two of us relating, then we are a dyad. And that dyad is based on the fact that one of us is paying attention to the other, and or we are engaging in some activity together. Then we've created a dyad. What would happen if we added a third person? Then what would we call it? A triad. Four? Quadrad, tetrad is usually what we use for four. Five, the quintet. Six is the sextet, you know, in music. 12 is a chamber choir, a woodwind orchestra, something like that. Why do we focus on dyads? Because as soon as you include more than two people and try to look at what's going on between them, you get very quickly overwhelmed. So we'll start with dyads. That is primarily what Bronfenbrenner deals with. We'll extend it when we look at the microsystem, which will include all of the different dyads. And we're going to stick to trying to understand two people relating to each other, but we're going to understand that when there are three of us, there are three dyads. A and B are in a dyad, and B and C are in a dyad, and C and A are in a dyad. So if there's a triad, then we have three dyads. And if there are six of us, you can quickly do the math. I always forget. When there are six of us, there are a whole bunch of dyads. What? 12, 13, 15, I don't know. All the different combinations of two. And it's enough if you can keep straight what is happening in each dyad. But recognize that if you're living in an apartment with five people, you have a whole bunch of dyads to take into account. And each one of them is unique, each one of them is different. And it gets pretty complex to try to analyze them the more people you have. So Bronfenbrenner will talk about dyads. He'll talk about settings in which there are multiple dyads, but he's not going to try to deal with, and psychology generally and sociology have an incredible time trying to deal with behavior within a group. It's extremely difficult. So Bronfenbrenner perhaps wisely leaves larger interpersonal systems up to the family systems people who try to deal with larger numbers, and the small group dynamics people who do that. So he says, if we can describe a dyad and then we can talk about the impact of dyads on each other, we've probably done as much as we need to do in thinking about development. So that's where we're going. We're going to look at dyads, and we're going to look at types of dyads. And Bronfenbrenner suggests that there are three types that are important based on the function, what's going on in the dyad. And the first of those is an observational dyad. That's what happens when you watch me and listen to me. So you and I, you individually and I are in an observational dyad. I'm aware that you're watching and listening, paying attention. I'm aware when you're not. He knows when you are listening. He knows when you're asleep. And I have a dyadic relationship with each of you all at the same time. And hopefully we can move it beyond an observational dyad, but probably I can't converse with all of you and listen to all of you at the same time, so don't. See, when I call on you, okay, when I call on you individually and ask you to speak, then we're creating a dialogue, talking two together. And because we're talking together, it's probably a joint activity dyad, and I can do that only with you one at a time. It would be fun to see how many of you I could actually listen to if I had 8 or 10 or 12 of you. You know what happens in that situation. You go nuts, and you overwhelm the system very quickly. So we're in observational dyads, and occasionally we create a joint activity dyad here when we're doing something together. Occasionally, I will ask you to converse in pairs together. Come up with something to say about a particular issue or topic and talk to each other about it. That's creating a whole bunch of joint activity dyads. And the third kind that's important to him in his scheme is a primary dyad. You may have many joint activity dyads that you engage in. You may play tennis with one person, flute duets with another. You may eat with somebody. You may cook with somebody. You know, all of those are joint activity dyads. You probably have them with all of your friends individually at different times. But the next type, the third type, he calls a primary dyad, because that means that it is a dyad that lasts, that it goes beyond having a joint activity, and you have in fact become part of each other's psychological field. You have entered each other's minds, you have gotten under each other's skin, and you think about each other, even when you're not together. A primary dyad. So, and it's both of you think about each other. It's not one of you thinks about the other and the other one doesn't know you exist. That's called a crush. Yeah. Or unrequited love. Or daydreaming or whatever you want to call it. But it's not a primary dyad unless both people have let the other person get under your skin and in your mind so that you can think about each other. Now, how's a primary dyad different from a joint activity dyad? Just simply that something has happened. Either the joint activities have gone on long enough or something else has happened to create the idea of future joint activities. That means that this person is important to you, at least enough for you to think about. They wonder where she is or he is. What's he doing? What's she doing? With your cell phones and text messaging, you can check up all the time. I'm not going there today. I'll get on my soapbox again about that later. But thank you all for turning off your cell phones during class. Okay, so we have different kinds of dyads that we're going to distinguish. And you can think about all the people you know and think about whether you engage in joint activities with them. And then think about the subset of those people whom you actually think about periodically during the day, on the weekend, once a month, whatever. The ones that you think about, if the other person also thinks about you, are primary dyads. And then Bronfenbrenner suggests that these kinds of dyads are not distinct or separated from each other, that in fact after you engage in a behavior of observing, you're likely to become a joint activity dyad. So if the other person knows you're watching and becomes self-conscious about that, you're likely to get a response such as, well, what's important to you? Why are you watching me? Or, hi, you're kind of cute. You want to come sit with me? Or whatever the activity then becomes, to convert that observational dyad into a joint activity dyad. So you observe the same person in class, maybe two different courses. You say, oh, okay, so this is a person who might be in the same major. So you introduce yourself and have a conversation. That's a joint activity. After you engage in joint activities over a period of time, hypothesis three suggests that you're likely to convert that over time into a primary dyad. So you might say, well, you know, let's go out for coffee, let's go out for lunch, let's study together. And if things are going well in the dyad and you don't decide, okay, I don't want to spend any more time with this person, she's really, he's a creep, or I feel uncomfortable around this person, too needy, a leech, you're not going to continue that. If the feelings are positive and you enjoy being with the person, you enjoy having the joint activities with the person, then you're likely to start thinking about that person. Oh, gee, if I'm going to go out for coffee, maybe I'll call Fred and see if he wants to go out for coffee with me. So you're thinking about Fred even when Fred's not around, because you associate him with enjoying a cup of coffee, and maybe he'll pay for it. Okay? Or you owe him. And owing somebody keeps them on your mind. Okay? So Bronfenbrenner is simply asserting that we tend to create relationships by observing other people who are interesting, or they're there and we observe them. That creates the observational dyad. That is likely, but it's not inevitable. Sometimes you observe somebody and you end up then in a joint activity dyad with that person. And some of those, again, not all of them, but some of them then may progress to being primary dyads. And the primary dyads are likely to continue to have joint activities in them. So what you're doing is adding levels of complexity to the relationship. So you start by observing each other, and then you add activities. So you're likely to continue to do both of those in a joint activity dyad. And then you let the person under your skin, you're likely to continue to do activities with the person, and now it's a primary dyad. You think about the activities, you think about the other person, so you're just making it more complex. Bronfenbrenner will add later in the book a fourth kind, which is the developmental dyad. And that is one that has specific characteristics of the activities and the relationships in it. And for that, he's looking at those specific people in your life who nurture your development, who make it possible for you to engage in more complex activities. People in your life who tend to increase the validity and the complexity of your view of the world. Those are the people who are pushing your development along because of their relationship with you. And we'll talk about that one in a bit. But be aware that he's defined these three functional types, and then he's going to add a fourth called a developmental dyad. And the developmental dyads have specific characteristics. They tend to be ones you observe, you engage in joint activities, they're probably primary, and they go beyond that to have specific characteristics of promoting your development in specific ways. So we'll get there. Okay, what happens if you get into a relationship with somebody, Brunton-Brenner proposes that if one of you changes, then the other one is likely to as well. And what he's referring to here is the basic notion that when you look at relationships, it's helpful to think of them as transactions and to use a transactional view of relationships. And a transactional view means that you accept the fact that what happens in a dyad or in a relationship is a joint product of the two people. It is not either person. It is what they do together. And this is an important concept in looking at relationships and development, the parent-child dyad, the couple relationship, and it's important conceptually to be able to think transactionally, and Brunton-Brenner assumes that you can do that. So what does it mean to be transactional? Well, first we might think about what is an action. An action is something you do. Okay. So I walk into a store. That's an action. There's no dyad involved. There's no relationship involved. I'm just in the store. Now, it's a molar activity for me because it has purpose and momentum. I am after a jumpsuit. Let's make it a leisure suit. That's back in my day. You don't remember leisure suit. Okay, anyway, what I want is a leisure suit and jacket and pants. And I want them purple with yellow polka dots. It's very important for me to get that leisure suit, and it needs to be purple, just the right shade. It has to go well with my eyes and my hair, my skin color. And it needs to have yellow, not gold, polka dots. So here I am, I'm on a molar activity, I'm on a search, and that's an action. Ah, a clerk appears, a sales associate, and responds to my being there. We now are in a dyad. He observed me. Now we're about to engage in a joint activity dyad and transfer some information. May I help you? I hope so. I'm looking for a leisure suit. It needs to be purple with just the right shade, and it needs to have yellow polka dots. And it needs to be in my size. And the sales associate, being well-trained, does not roll his eyes, doesn't gag, but says, oh, let me see. I think maybe we have leisure suits in the back left over from the 60s. And let's see if we have anything your size. And we go and we look at the rack. It's the clearance rack. And they don't have anything. So I leave. We have engaged in an interaction. Okay? We came in, we created a temporary dyad, we engaged in a joint activity. We had an interaction, we exchanged some information. He tried to talk me into buying a denim leisure suit. But I didn't want a denim one. I've got a denim one, so I wanted the purple one with the yellow polka dots. And I left. Now, it probably will not be a primary dyad, but he may keep me in mind for the rest of the day, and he'll go home and he'll tell his partner about the really weird guy who came in and was looking for a... Can you believe it? The guy was looking for a purple... Anyway, that's an interaction, and it will feed his interactions. He'll have a story. I'm not going to think about him again, so it's not a primary dyad. And then I go into another store. And same thing happens. I walk in. That's my action. There's a reaction from the clerk. We have an interaction. And lo and behold, they have, fortunately, on the clearance rack, so it cost me only $7, they have the right kind of leisure suit, purple with yellow, and I buy it. I give him my credit card. Actually, for $7, I can probably pay cash. I take the leisure suit after I've tried it on. I leave. We have engaged in a transaction. Okay. And the transaction is that we did all the other stuff, and then I left my money. I took the leisure suit. We have both been changed. And that's what makes it a transaction. I now am happily in possession of the leisure suit. I can end that molar activity and now get dressed up for going out on the town and impressing whoever it is I'm going to try to impress in a purple leisure suit. I mean, everybody's going to be impressed, right? So it's going to lead to all kinds of new transactions that I'm going to have, which was my purpose in the first place. He has made a sale. He's gotten his commission if he gets it. He's gotten rid of that stupid thing that's been hanging on the rack for 25 years. His boss is going to be happy. His life has been changed. My life has been changed. And that makes it a transaction. Okay. So Rompenbrenner is going to focus us on the transactions in relationships, because the things that change us are likely to be important in our development. You can go through the same interaction with the same person. You can engage in all kinds of interactions with a person, and if none of them change you, they're probably not terribly important. It's the, hi, how are you? Fine, thanks. That's an interaction. So what? It means you live in a friendly community. That says something about the ecosystem, but it doesn't change you. What you're interested in is the transaction. And the transaction is not something I did. It's not something the clerk did, the sales associate, the sales professional. It's not something either of us did. It is the result of the collaboration between us, and it took two to tango to create the transaction. And if we're going to look at it, the transaction is what happens within a dyad as a result of the mutual actions which are related to each other of both people. So in a transactional notion, we have to account for each person and what they collaboratively and bidirectionally did that led to the transaction that changed each of them. The relationship is the consequence of the mutual, bidirectional, collaborative stuff that went on between them, and it is a consequence of the behavior of both people, and it cannot be understood as the result of either person's behavior individually. It is unique to the specific pair of people and what they did. Okay. Got it? Keep that in mind. There are a couple of implications of taking a transactional view. And one of those implications is what Rompenbrenner presents in Proposition C. If one of the people goes through some kind of developmental change, the other person is likely to go through some kind of change too. It may not be the same kind of change, but what it means is that if you're in a relationship and A changes in some significant way, that's going to alter what A puts into the relationship, into the transaction. B is now responding to different behaviors and is going to change because B is engaging in a transaction that is now different, and in order to keep up with that transaction is going to have to re-understand the other person and the relationship. Not always, but often enough that we need to think about what happens when one person in a dyad goes through a developmental change. Let me give you a specific example. What happens... let's use a simple one. What happens when an infant learns to talk? Infant becoming toddler learns to talk. What happens to the transaction with the parent? It now becomes bidirectionally verbal. Presumably, if we have a good parent, the parent has been talking to the infant from the beginning, from before the beginning, from before birth, maybe even before conception. I'm not going there. But certainly after conception, the parent is likely to be talking to the baby, the fetus, and that goes on after birth, but the infant isn't using words to respond. They're having a transaction. But what happens when the baby is able to express his or her wishes and her responses and to talk about activities and to think about the future as she or he develops language is that the relationship with the parent is going to change, and the parent is going to have to change his or her view of the infant and what is possible. So you can prepare for change in your day by talking to the infant. And that requires that you think of, okay, the infant can understand, the toddler now can understand that, so I can change the way I relate to the toddler, and I can anticipate things. That takes some of the hassle out of parenting. I can also, instead of guessing, I can ask about the toddler's state of mind and feeling. So the nature of the relationship changes, and that requires that the parent change his or her view of the toddler and of the potential in interacting with the toddler to help the toddler, A, learn vocabulary and deal with his or her environment differently. So if the toddler is going to learn to talk, the relationship is going to change, and as it changes, the parent is going to change his or her view. That was driven home to me not long ago when I was talking with a father who was obviously just delighted and engaged in interaction, verbal interaction and play with his daughter, and they were having a wonderful time in the grocery store, and he was teaching vocabulary and they were both laughing and they were playing verbal games and it was really fun, and I commented on the relationship. I'm likely to do that, you know, I see things I like and say, hey, that's, you know, what a great kid, and he's, it's like you really enjoy being a dad. And he said, yeah, I said, you know, just her language is terrific. She's going to be a very verbal kid. I, you know, the kind of crap that comes out when you're passing time. And he said, yeah, you know, I was just thinking about that this morning. I can't remember what it was like. I can't imagine what it was like now when we couldn't talk to each other. And silently through my mind went, maybe he didn't spend any time with her before she learned to talk. But he had clearly gone through a change in his understanding of his daughter and his enjoyment of her, because he was clearly verbally clued in and depended on it very much. You can think about what happens when you go through the developmental changes of puberty, relationship to your parent probably changed, and your parent has to change the way he or she deals with you, what they have to worry about. Okay, so the proposition makes a little bit of sense. Let me give you another implication of having a transactional view. I said it takes two to tango to create a relationship, and a transactional view helps you understand how to change a relationship effectively. One of the issues for us, if we're not thinking transactionally, if you're A in the relationship and you don't like what's going on, our tendency is to assume that it's because B is not doing the right thing. If you're having a lot of conflict with your mother, it's because your mother is really weird. Or maybe she's going through menopause. If your boyfriend isn't pleasing you, it's because he doesn't know how to be a boyfriend. Or maybe he doesn't like you, but it's clearly his fault if you're not happy with the relationship. You're unlikely to think, oh, gee, I'm not happy in this relationship, I must be doing the wrong thing. No, it's always the other person. If you're thinking non-transactionally, it's always the other person's fault. Children and teenagers are very likely to think it's always the other person's fault. Or maybe it really is my fault. Maybe I'm no good. Maybe I'm dumb. Maybe I'm incompetent. Maybe I should go eat worms. I'm not doing what I should be doing. But if you take a transactional view, you get rid of the blame and the guilt. At least part of it. Transactional view says, the relationship that I'm not happy with is what's happening between us, and the only thing I can change is what I do. Maybe I need to tell the other person exactly how I would like her to behave. Maybe I could tell the other person the conditions under which I am unhappy. But what you heard me saying is maybe I could, not he needs to do this, she's not doing this right. I can change what I do in the relationship. And in fact, that's all I can change. I can change what I put into this relationship. I cannot make the other person change. How often do we spend our time trying to get the other person to change? Most of the time. We try to get the other person to change. We blame the other person for not being what we want him or her to be. Now that's putting something in, but blame and complaint are not likely to create a better relationship, because what I'm putting in is negative energy. But if I think, now how could I make this relationship better? How could I make it clearer what I want? Then, if I look at the implication of Proposition C, if I'm changing what I put into the transaction, maybe what the other person will put in will become more what I want. Fundamental principle in couples therapy. Fundamental principle in parent-child consultation. Parent comes in moaning and groaning about the kid's behavior. Wants you to fix the kid. Right? Parents often get upset when they say, well, your child is actually just responding appropriately to the crap that you're doing. We don't say that. We say, is it possible that if you changed the way you respond to this behavior that you don't like, that perhaps the child would have more options and some of them might be behaving in a way that would be more comfortable for you, and perhaps if you stop making the kid feel like a total loser failure and like he or she can do no good and like you're always on the kid's back, if you change that and expressed perhaps just once that you really like the kid and want to have a good relationship with the kid, maybe the kid would see some hope in this relationship, and we'll talk about the specifics and script you in what to say under certain circumstances that might give the kid more opportunity to put good behavior into this transaction. Parents get annoyed because we're not fixing the kid. What we're doing is trying to fix the transaction, because we know we can't fix the kid. They didn't teach me. I'm a child psychologist. They didn't teach me how to fix kids. I can change relationships in ways that will make parents and kids both happier. But I have to work on the person who is able to change his or her behavior because six-year-olds are not very good at deliberately changing their behavior. They are constantly engaged in transactions. And the adult is the person with the responsibility to change the nature of that transaction. Similarly, in a couple. A couple comes in, she's complaining about he drinks too much, and when he drinks, he's unpleasant, and she can't trust him, and she's got all this work to do, and when he's drinking, he can't help take care of the kids, and he's heard all this before, and what does he do when he hears the complaint? It makes him feel really bad, so he goes and has another drink. Duh. The worse she makes him sound, the more he feels he needs to drink, and the more adamant he is that he's not going to change. So the first thing you do is tell her to stop complaining. And then we'll look at the enabling behavior. We know we can't change him. I can prescribe antabuse. I can't personally, but we can do that. We can try to get him to want to change his drinking behavior. But until he sees that there's a better option, it won't work. He will need to make that decision, and he will make that decision when she stops enabling. And she gets annoyed because we suggest that she needs to stop enabling. It's not her who needs to change, it's him who needs to stop drinking. But she can't change his drinking. She can only change the relationship and stop supporting his drinking. And she says, but I don't support his drinking, I hate it. Well, let's look at what you do when he drinks. Okay, he spent the weekend plastered, right? And he woke up Monday morning and he was too hungover to go to work. So you called his boss and you made up some lame excuse, right? Yeah, that's enabling. Let him call the boss. Let him make up his own excuse. Why are you doing it? You're making it okay for him to be hungover. Oh, okay. You make excuses with your friends. So you make it safe and easy for him to drink. Don't do that. He's drinking. Let him take the consequences. Well, he'll lose his job. Well, you know, maybe if he loses his job, and you, and the kids, and his dignity, and his pension, and his car, and his license, and all that, maybe he'll be motivated to stop drinking. But as long as you make it possible for him to drink without any consequences, he has no reason to stop. Oh. Yeah. Enablers in a dyad or in a microsystem generally, in a setting, in a family, support the behavior they say they don't want to have happen. And many of us spend a lot of our time trying to get somebody else to stop a behavior that he or she really has no reason to change. So, bottom line is, if you want a person to stop drinking, stop supporting the drinking. If you want a person not to use drugs and alcohol, stop supporting the drugs and alcohol, and stop assuming that you can rescue this person from his or her addiction because you can't. So don't. In fact, probably, this is Uncle Larry's advice. If you are currently in a relationship with somebody who has an alcohol and drug problem, get out. Tell them to come see you when they're finished with the addiction. When they're clean, when they're dry, when they've learned to control it, you might be interested in them. But as long as they annoy you with their drinking or their drug use or scare you with their driving or their drug use, as long as you are hanging in trying to change them when you can't do that, probably the easiest, unless you're married, not even if you're married, the best thing to do is get out of the relationship. Why suffer? Especially if your suffering is going to support the drinking or the drug use. I know. Many of you have friends and partners who drink too much and do drugs, and you think you can rescue them and turn them into nice, safe people and happy people, and they'll kill themselves or drink themselves to death if you leave the relationship, That rarely happens. And as long as they tell you that and you believe it, it's called blackmail and extortion and control, and it's abusive. So, you know, tell them you love them very much, very happy, they're very creative, and as soon as they get off the sauce, off the drugs, you'll be back. Just let you know when that is. And you'll save yourself a lot of grief down the road. You don't deserve a partner who's, or a friend who's out of control and makes your life miserable. You don't deserve it. And they don't deserve you maintaining their habit. So what you do is you send them to Al-Anon. Or you go to Al-Anon, they go to alcohol, AA, AA. And AA and Al-Anon use a transactional approach which says you are only responsible for your own behavior, and you have to understand what you put in the transaction. So if you go to AA and complain that your wife doesn't support your drinking, they will say, why should she? You drink. You're an alcoholic. Stop it. The only person who can stop it is you. So first, stop denying that you're an alcoholic. Step one. You got 11 steps to go. And 10 or 11 out there is apologize to all the people you've hurt by your behavior. You have to take responsibility for it yourself. Don't expect anybody else to do it, and don't blame anybody else for the fact that you drink. You are number one, and you are responsible for what you do, and that's all there is. And if you don't want that, you're not ready for AA. Keep coming to meetings, and you'll listen to our stories, and we'll tell you how we quit. But we quit because we wanted to quit, because we wanted to have good transactions with other people, and alcohol keeps you from doing that. Al-Anon will give you, for friends and relatives, Al-Anon will give you support for changing your enabling behavior. You know, so you can't change the fact that your spouse or your son or your parent is an alcoholic or a drug addict, but we can help you keep it from driving you nuts, and we can help you quit supporting the behavior and understand where the responsibility is. Okay? So that's a transactional view. Our understanding of relationships in development will assume that we are all in transactional relationships with important people, and that we have to understand those transactionally. We have to think about what each person is putting in to the relationship, into the dyad, in order to keep it going as it is, and how you might change the relationship to make it better. But you change it by changing what you put in. We will also, and particularly in the book that you will read by Galinsky, The Six Stages of Parenthood, we will look at the fact that a child is developing and changing constantly what he or she puts into the relationship with the parent. And because of that, parents are faced regularly with the need to see their child differently and to behave differently with their child. So as the child changes, and that's built in, the parent is constantly trying to catch up and adapt to the changing transaction. The transactions are changing because the child is changing. And you'll enjoy the fact that that book is very solidly transactional. Okay. If we're going to look at relations in a dyad, what do we need to understand? And Bronfenbrenner is very provocative here. He says that out of all the thousands of things that psychologists and psychiatrists have looked at in relationships, probably most of them boil down to three basic concepts. Important, powerful concepts, and these are the three characteristics. Affect, power, and reciprocity. And what I would like you to be able to do by the end of this unit is whenever we talk about a dyad, I would like you to have a reflex in your brain that says, ah, dyad, affect, reciprocity, power. Power, affect, reciprocity. P-A-R-R-A-P-A-P-R-A-R-P. Whatever mnemonic device you want to use. It's either RAP, PAR, abbreviation for April, ARP, whatever you want. Think A-R-P anytime you think about a dyad, and that'll get you to think about affect, reciprocity, and power. And they're defined and discussed in the book, so I'm not going to go terribly far into that, except that we need to be sure that we're talking about affect as the emotional tone, power as relative strength, and reciprocity as the give and take in the relationship. And this is one of those wonderful examples where the three are interrelated. A relationship that has positive affect is likely to be highly reciprocal. Or not, but it tends to be. A relationship that is relatively balanced in power is likely to be one that you feel better about, so the affect is likely to be positive. But not necessarily. We can always come up with the conditions in which these three don't imply each other. But each of them can be described as existing on a continuum. So if we're thinking about affect, it can be really nasty and hateful to hate somebody, and you hate them intensely. That's very negative. Or you can love them to pieces and think they're the best thing since sliced bread and life wouldn't be worth living without them. Positive. I love you. You make me happy when I'm near you. That's positive affect. And then you probably have some relationships that are neutral. Okay. Well, it's not painful. It doesn't make me really happy. You know, we study together and that's effective, but he's not a person I'd hang out with for other purposes, so it's kind of neutral. So when you think about affect, the emotional tone in a dyad, you have to be able to talk about whether it's negative, neutral, or positive, or moving in one direction or the other. Is it becoming less positive? Is it becoming more negative? If it's becoming less positive, it is becoming more negative. So you move back and forth. And what will be important for us is whether relationships are positive or becoming positive, because that's typically good for the relationship. Maybe. We can talk about situations in which I may feel wonderful about a relationship and the affect may be really positive and you may enjoy it too, and it may be a really sick relationship. It may not be good for your development at all. I may make you happy by hurting you. If I'm a sadist, well, you know what a sadist is, the person who makes a masochist happy. And if I can make you miserable and that makes you feel comfortable because you're used to feeling miserable and you think you deserve feeling miserable, then I can be really happy in the relationship and it may not be doing you much good. I may be hurting you. I may be exploiting you. So it's probably not developmentally good for you, even though it's a good relationship, a positive relationship for me. If we think about reciprocity in a relationship, that also falls along a continuum from no reciprocity, low or no reciprocity, to very high reciprocity. And in a relationship that has no reciprocity, it means that I do all the hurting, you do all the suffering, and that doesn't change. I initiate all the activities, and you go along with whatever I want. I get what I want, you don't get anything except maybe the thrill of being in a relationship which you're desperate for. So there's very low reciprocity, and again, it's not likely to be a wonderfully developmental relationship. It may not be good for either of us. So when we talk about the reciprocity, we need to be able to talk about whether the reciprocity is very low, kind of moderate, or high, and which direction it's going. When we look at power, the third characteristic, that also comes on a continuum from A has all of it. The parent can squash you like a bug when you're born, except it's illegal. But you have all the power. At the other end of the continuum, the other person in the dyad has all the power, and you don't have any. And in the middle, you have balanced power. You both have equal power. So a relationship can be imbalanced in one direction or the other. It can be changing. One person can be gaining more power. There can be more power sharing. It may be moving toward an equal balance of power. So in each case, there's a dimension or continuum, and in each case it's different. The concepts are different. And in an ideal relationship, for our purposes, typically the relationship is, the affect is going to be positive. The power is going to be balanced. It's going to be equal between the two people or moving in that direction. So for affect, we want it at one end of the continuum. For power, we want it balanced eventually. And in reciprocity, we want it to be high. We want both people to be putting into this relationship and being able to change roles in it. So it's going to be high. They're different terms. They imply each other, as did purpose or intent and momentum, and they're clearly related to each other, but they're different. Bronfenbrenner, as I said, took the thousands of concepts that we use to try to describe relationships and said, well, what's really important about them? And these were his best shot. A lot of the literature that we have can be translated into these three concepts. Some would be looking at one of these three, some will be looking at two, some will be looking at some combination. They may call it something different. And there are, again, hundreds and many hundreds of other concepts we could look at. He said they probably translate into these, or they may not be important for development. Okay. As an exercise, it's fairly common that we want parents to love their children. We want our partners to love us. We want that to be mutual. Love probably can be translated into these three. And one of the things I'll ask you to do in the next unit particularly is to think about what kind of relationship you want. And if you want a loving relationship, see if you can translate what you mean in those. I can't tell if a parent, and this is an old soapbox for me. Parents say they love their kids. All parents say they love their kids. Well, sometimes they hate their kids, usually during puberty. But what does that mean? What does that mean? When I look at the transaction between the parent and the child, how do I measure love? I can translate it into those three. I can translate it into behaviors. So one of the exercises I used to do in child development was to say, okay, we all want parents to love their children. What do parents who love their children do? Can you give it to me in behavioral terms? What are the activities that a loving parent engages in? What are the characteristics of the transaction without using the word love? Can I do it? Can I define it? And I'll ask you to do the same thing. Can you say what it is a loving partner does? What are the behaviors of loving people in a relationship? What are the activities that they engage in? What are the transactions that they create in the dyad that make you think that they are loving partners? And that is not an academically cute question, because when you're in a relationship, a partner is very likely to say, I love you. And the question is, if you feel loved, what about the transaction are you engaging in? Being told that somebody loves you may make you feel good, but if most of what the person does makes you feel bad, maybe we need to translate love into behavior and think about the characteristics of the transaction that the person would engage in other than saying, I love you, because there are probably behavioral manifestations of that affect if it's real. A person who says, I hit you because I love you, is insane. You don't do that. You don't hit people if you love them. But many people engage in violent behavior with people they say they love. Look at the behavior and how it makes you feel. And translate it into those three. Okay, go out and have good affects.